I sat and watched Joe Cocker's set in The Brilliant Sunshine, and then we were due to go on next, but Country Joe and the Fish, they said they'd never follow us. They played at Fillmore East with us as headliners and said they couldn't follow us, and Joe said he would never do that again. I think the people in the bar had recognised us, and somebody got up and put the single on, but they put the B-side on, so it played at 45, so it was twice as fast as it should be. But the bizarre thing was they got up and danced to it, and when it had finished, they applauded us. It was bizarre. So we finished our drinks and left.
Hello and welcome to episode 29 of Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate twice-weekly classic rock podcast that proudly claims that my music is better than yours. I'm Paul Stevenson, thanks as always for hitting play. Now, very quick mention before we start, I have a pair of weekend tickets plus camping to give away to a lucky listener for the brilliant Stone Dead Festival 2021. Black Star Riders, Gunn, Blaze Bailey from Iron Maiden, Terrorvision, loads of great acts all performing live. Now, to win, just go to my website, vintagerockpod.com, click on the Win Stone Dead Tickets link at the top, answer the ridiculously easy question, it really is, to get your name in the draw for those tickets. Live music is coming back, you can win a pair of those tickets now. Right, back to matters at hand. On last week's show, we had a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, Doug Cosmo Clifford from Creedence Clearwater Revival. If you've not listened yet, definitely check it out, it's a great interview. Now, they famously played Woodstock, but they weren't featured in the film or in the initial album because John Fogerty wasn't happy with their performance. But one band that was featured on those, though, which helped to shoot them to fame in America, was British blues rock group 10 Years After. Now, their epic, blistering, and now legendary version of I'm Going Home earned them fans all over the world. Alvin Lee's incredible vocals, viciously quick guitar work matched with the thunderous rhythm section of Leo Lyons on bass and Rick Lee on the drums makes it an obvious standout. Now, the band had some big hits both sides of the Atlantic, and they released 4 top 20 albums stateside, and they had 4 top 10 albums in the UK, including 3 that went top 5 as well. Now, as well as playing Woodstock, they also played another legendary festival, the Isle of Wight Festival 1970, which, according to the Guinness Book of Records, had a bigger crowd than Woodstock, with estimates of over 600,000 people. Which, when you think we're all crammed onto a field on a little island off the south coast of England, is pretty insane, isn't it? Now, I'm delighted to say I spoke to 10 Years After drummer Rick Lee recently. He's 75, but he's still going strong. And we spoke about the early days of the band, of course, Woodstock and the Isle of Wight festivals, his autobiography, and what the band are doing nowadays with himself and fellow original member Chick Churchill still involved. So here you go. Here's my chat with the legendary rock blues drummer Rick Lee from 10 Years After. I'm delighted to be joined by one of the heroes of the British rock and blues scene from the 60s and 70s, and still going strong today, plugging a fantastic album, which we're going to talk about very soon indeed. Please welcome to Vintage Rock Pod, Rick Lee from 10 Years After.
Hey, how you doing, Paul? I'm well.
Good stuff. Keeping well in these busy, strange times. That's probably the best way of putting it, isn't it?
It is indeed. Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, you're here to talk to us about exciting new deluxe edition album that you're bringing out. But before that, let's have a little chat about your band. I mean, because let's be honest, 10 Years After are a legendary group and everyone knows them. They've been on the go for 50 years. You know what I mean? It's one of these bands which just lives long in the memory. Now, tell us about where you all started from, because in your book, which we'll talk about soon as well, you talk about humble beginnings and the rough and tumble of it all. I mean, where did you four guys originally get together?
Well, I was in a band called The Mansfields in Mansfield, believe it or not. And I had a drum teacher there, a guy called Dave Quickmire, who was one third of a band called The Jaybirds. And the other two thirds were Alvin Lee and Leo Lyons. And Dave basically schooled me up to take over his place in the drum seat. He wanted to leave and get married, and he had enough of touring with the band. So I did an audition, which I passed, thanks to Dave. He'd schooled me up in the things I needed to know for Alvin. And they offered me the job. I took a couple of days to think about it, but anyway, I decided that Alvin, being such a phenomenal guitarist, he could play anything. He got the label Mr. Speedfingers, but Captain Speedfingers, rather. But he was a lot more than that. He could play jazz, blues, country. I mean, you name it, he could do it. He was phenomenal. So I took my chances with them. I think maybe a year after I joined them, we got an audition down in London for a stage show, which we passed. Chick Churchill had become friendly with Alvin, and Alvin had asked him to join the band. But for the show that we did in London, they only wanted the three-piece. Okay. However, the show was supposed to run for 2 years. It lasted for about 6 weeks, and we were then out of a job. But we managed to secure ourselves a gig back in the Ivy League, who had had several big hits at that time, three singers, harmony singers. And we toured with them, and we rode Chicken as roadie, and then got him playing keyboards as well with us. So that's how Chick came into the band. We then did an audition at the Marquee Club in 1967, I think it was. We passed that. We got the interval spot with on a Sunday evening with the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. Received standing ovations there. And we were called the Blues Yard for that one gig. Chris Wright, who became our manager, came down from Manchester, where he was an agent at the time, and said he would like to manage us, but we had to change the name. And so Leo then went through the Radio Times, which, as you know, is the TV programs as well as radio. And he went through with a pin, with his eyes shut, went down the list. I think there were two contenders. There was Life Without Mother or 10 Years After. The choices were then sent to Manchester, and the staff voted for 10 Years After, which I think was a lucky choice. So that's how it came about.
Absolutely fantastic. I'm glad you cleared the name up as well, because there's been often conflicting reports. One story, it was in honour of Elvis Presley, one of Lee's idols, and things like that. So that's quite fascinating to hear. Now, as you said there, 1967, that was the year you brought out the first album as well. And then a couple of years later, you brought out two huge albums, didn't you? Mean Stonehenge, which really put you on the map, and Shush as well.
Yeah. Actually, the thing that put us on the map in America was Undead. We were making Stonehenge at the time, but we weren't going to get it ready in time. It was a studio album. It's quite experimental. So we quickly recorded a live album in the pub next door to Decca Studios. They slung the cables over the roof. They'd recorded John Mayall a couple of times, I think, and Zoot Money as well, all the bands that were on Decca at that time. And we made that and put that out quickly in the States. Because prior to that, the first album had been released in the States, but nobody really knew it existed. It more or less escaped. But Bill Graham, who was the promoter at Fillmore West in San Francisco, heard it and sent a telegram to Chris Wright and said, if you're ever in America, please play my venue. Give me the details of the deal you'll require. So Chris then went crazy to get the money together to get us over there. I think he got in those days, you'd get tour support from the record company. So I think London Records, which was Decca's American arm, put up some money. And I think he got some publishing advances on Alvin's songs. And that's why we did Undead. That came out. And it was actually Woodchopper's Ball was this song that really broke us in America. That grabbed everybody's attention for some reason. I never quite figured that out, but there you go. And then, as you said, we moved in and we did Stonehenge, which was pretty experimental, had lots of different silly things on it. And then Shush, which had the big track on that one was Good Morning Little Schoolgirl, which was also then banned in America, which, of course, made us even more popular.
Absolutely. And speaking about making you popular in America, 1969 was, of course, the legendary Woodstock. And you guys played there and absolutely wowed the crowds. But was it true that you were very close to not actually being involved in that event?
In Woodstock, yeah. We were on a tour. We'd done several tours by then of America. We used to do 3 months at a time, which I think is what put strain on the band later. Mm-hmm. But, it was just a sort of regular tour. The night before, we'd been in, we'd actually played a couple of months earlier, we played the Seattle Pop Festival, which was actually 50,000 people. And that was a three-day weekend. And a lot of people who played that played Woodstock. That was a great festival, fantastic weather. And we saw Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry, which he'd never seen before. So that was a fantastic event for us. And then we did the Newport Jazz Festival. And the night before Woodstock, we were actually on tour with Nina Simone as the part of the Newport Jazz Festival on tour. In the meantime, Frank Barcelona, our agent, was pestering Chris Wright to do this gig in upstate New York, which was going to be big, as he put it. They were expecting 50,000 people. So Chris asked him what the money was, and the money was pretty poor by comparison to what we were getting in Auditoria and other festivals. So Chris said, well, what are we going to do that for? You know, we're doing fine as we are. We'll give that one a miss. Frank kept ringing him and he'd say, so-and-so is joining, another band's joined, so-and-so's joined. And also people were starting to come from all over the world to it, and the press were picking up on it. It was getting bigger by the day.
Yeah.
So the final call that Frank made, he said, look, you're crazy not to do this. Jefferson Airplane are doing it. Janis Joplin's just signed. The Who are going to do it, because Frank was after The Who as well. And he said, and finally, I just heard Hendrix is signing. So you've got to do this. It'd be mad not to do it. So Chris acquiesced, luckily, and we did it.
Brilliant stuff. And what's your memories of that festival itself then? Because I spoke recently to Cosmo from Creedence, and he was just saying, a bit like you, were expecting 50,000, and then he had to get helicoptered in, and it was just absolute bedlam.
It was certainly difficult to get in. People had abandoned their cars on the, and blocked the roads. We couldn't get within any nearer than 6 miles. So we flew down from St. Louis, as I said, from the night before, into New York. We were picked up by two cars. The only food we'd had to eat was on the plane on the way down, and then drove up to Bethel, which was 6 miles from the site of Max Yazgur's farm. And there was a Holiday Inn there, which became known as Tranquility Base. And then we were trying to get some sleep, and we said, could we have a room? And the guy said, yeah, go pick any room you like. I thought, oh, great. Anyway, every room, of course, had a band in it already. And I think we shared with Janis Joplin and Big Brother. And I was just about to get my head down on my rucksack on the floor of the of that room when Dee Anthony, who was our American manager, came bustling in and said, come on, we got to go. We've got to be at the site. And we said, what are you on about? We're not playing till tonight. He said, no, they want you on this afternoon. You've got to get there. So, okay, so we went to get in the cars. He said, no, you can't go by car. We've got to go by helicopter. So we went up to the helipad, and there was a chopper standing there. And I was about to get in, and I was elbowed out of the way by a burly sort of bloke with a glasses and a ponytail, an older man. It turned out to be Albert Grossman, manager of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And with him were Stills, Young and Crosby. Graham Nash came later. I put in my book that Graham was there, but I found out from his book that he actually came over later. Anyway, we got in the next chopper that came, and there was a medic on board, and he said, whatever you do, don't eat anything that's not cooked, and don't drink anything that's not in a sealed can, or because we've got a potential outbreak of hepatitis, and we don't want it to become an epidemic. We're trying to control it. So from epidemic to pandemic,
yes.
that's the title of my next book. Anyway, we flew in. I mean, we were gobsmacked by the size of the crowd, you know, whatever it was, 300,000. I don't know. People say 3, 4, 5. It's anybody's guess. I don't think anybody counted. And I think that Michael Lang and Artie Cornfeld were very smart in that they declared it a free festival after the kids started breaking down the fences, because Woodstock to me is and always will be what it said on the tin, which is a festival of peace, love and music. If you contrast that with the 1970 with the Isle of Wight Festival the year later, the kids wanted that to be a free festival, started breaking down the fences, but the promoters set dogs on them and beat them with nightsticks, you know, truncheons. And it was not a pleasant flavour to that festival at all. Luckily, we'd left before all that happened, but so the two are an absolute contrast to each other. I think that's why Woodstock will always stand as the festival, if you like, of the 60s. Lots of people tried to copy it, but they never could. It was a one-off event. It happened organically. That was the word I was looking for. And we arrived, of course. There was I sat and watched Joe Cocker set in the Brilliant Sunshine, and then we were due to go on next, but Country Joe and the Fish went on. They said they'd never follow us. They played at Fillmore East with us as headliners and said they couldn't follow us, and Joe said he would never do that again. So they snuck on before us. And then Johnny Winter jumped in as well. And then the storm came, of course, and the whole stage was live because the covering was really inadequate. And it took about 2 hours to dry the stage out. Michael Lang quite rightly wouldn't allow anybody to play in case of electrocution. I mean, even the cameramen were getting shocks down their cables, you know, when they were touching the cameras. And consequently, all the foods, you know, the cooking facilities were knocked out, so there's no cooked food. And I never found a can that wasn't already open, so I didn't drink. I think later we got some bottled water brought in, you know, which was sealed, and we had that. We would have definitely had that on stage during the set. And then we went on about, well, I thought it was 10 o'clock at night, but I'm told it was 8:30. And we had to start Good Morning Little Schoolgirl about 3-4 times because the guitars wouldn't stay in tune because of the atmospherics. It was still quite damp. It had dried off pretty well by the time we hit the stage, but it was getting damp again from the condensation from it having been a bright summer's day, and then getting cooler in the evening. I take my hat off to the people there. I mean, they were sitting in mud. A lot of them relied totally on food parcels which had dropped from helicopters. And if somebody caught a parcel, then they would take it and share it with their neighbours, who they probably hardly knew. You know, they would have met in the few days that they'd been at Woodstock. But it was an incredibly peaceful affair. I don't think there was any violence. I think a couple of babies were born. And really, it's a sketch of what we could be like in the world if we put our minds to it. But I think, unfortunately, politicians get in the way.
Absolutely, and we could talk for a long time about that, but we're probably best to leave that one where it is. But in terms of, you mentioned a couple of false starts there in your Woodstock performance. I mean, that's going to be included on a special vinyl pressing that's coming out shortly as well, isn't it?
I heard the other day, sadly, it won't be coming out till 2022.
Oh, it's been delayed.
It is. However, Space and Time, most successful album, which had I'd Love to Change the World on it, which was a top 40 hit in 1970. It's the 50th anniversary of that album in October. And in order to do a special on that, which Chrysalis want to do, they've had to, because of COVID, you can imagine everybody's queuing up to get pressings of CDs and vinyl. So the timescale just wouldn't work for them to get that ready for June, July, which was the original plan. Mm-hmm. So they're going to work on Space and Time and then do the Woodstock album next year. It's really good. I've heard it. I've approved it a few weeks back. There is something happening in June, July. And I know what it is. There was a box set they put out before, which was basically the Alvin years from 67 to 84. And they've now put in that together in a clamshell edition, charging less for it. And that's coming out in June, July. So there's just been a few shuffles, as happens in our business, I'm afraid. But that's the rundown anyway. And currently, as you rightly said, we have this Deco Entertainment album out, which is a sting in the tail, the deluxe edition. It's deluxe because it has four live tracks added to it that were taken from a subsequent album we did called Naturally Live. Both those have been out in Europe and done really, really well, both on CD and vinyl. So, there's a lot happening for 10 years after this.
Absolutely. And if anyone's unaware of A Sting in the Tail, it's a fantastic album which came out maybe a couple of years ago. But in terms of the lineup and everything itself now, it's yourself and Chick, isn't it, from the originals, and then you've brought in Colin Hodgkinson, who's got a fantastic back catalogue himself. He's worked with Peter Green and Chris Rea and Spencer Davis, and then the guy that's fronting it and vocals, and he's an amazing guitarist as well, Marcus Bonfanti. I came across him about 10 years ago when he was doing his solo stuff. He's an absolutely formidable front man. He's got an incredible voice, and he is just a phenomenon leading you guys now, isn't he?
Oh, he's terrific. A great asset to the band, and a nice guy to boot.
Just touching on Sting in the Tail then, with the deluxe edition, just in case anyone who hasn't already heard it, and this is a great time to buy it obviously now with it being the deluxe and the extra tracks on there. In terms of the tracks on the album, I mean, for me, it starts off with an incredible song, and fans of my podcast know that I like a dark, ominous opening to a track, and Land of the Vandals is just one hell of a kick-ass track to start any album on, isn't it?
Well, that's kind of you to say so. I mean, we worked hard on all the tracks. We wanted to make a radio-friendly album. Just by comparison, if you take Up in Smoke, which is an acoustic type track, which is the longest track on the record, is 6 minutes. Mm-hmm. By comparison, the longest tracks in previous recordings was I Can't Keep From Crying Sometimes, which at one stage reached 19 minutes long, so which is not awfully radio friendly these days. So we worked hard to do that, and we're very proud of the album. It's the first one that Chick and I have been able to where we've had a collaborative process. You know, previously Alvin had written all the stuff, and we tried to write together, but he didn't want to do anybody else's material. But that was strange, because the first couple of albums were all covers. But anyway, there you go. Yeah, so we're really proud of the album.
And just talking about some of the stuff that you were involved with, one of the tracks, Saran Saran, came around for your love of an actress, didn't it?
Yes, I'm afraid it did. I see she's got a new series coming up soon as well, with Martin Comston from Line of Duty as well. Yes. He's in it. He's amazing, actually. I saw an interview with him on Jonathan Ross the other night. He's got a very broad Scots accent, but in Line of Duty, you never notice it.
Incredible. No, it shows what a good actor he is.
Yeah, so, I was watching Saran on TV, and, I went a bit overboard, but she's far too young by comparison to an old boy like me. So we wrote a song about it. Marcus and I put that one together.
Good stuff. And you mentioned that Sting in the Tail was a more radio-friendly album, because 10 years after, you're famously not a singles band. You weren't out to get AM radio play, pop radio play, that sort of stuff. But you still managed to have some really big hits. And you mentioned I'd Love to Change the World as a big hit in the US. And the one in the UK, which was a top 10 hit, went really big, was Love Like a Man. Although the record company, or whoever it was that decided on who were going to release it, managed to chop it from 7 minutes to three, didn't they, when they released it?
Well, Alvin certainly wasn't happy about that. Well, I don't think any of us were, but he certainly wasn't. And I mean, it's pretty silly, because the guitar solo just goes pew, and that's it, just one note. Because it was in the studio, we jammed it in the studio, you know.
Yeah.
So Alvin said, well, if you're doing that, then you've got to put the full version on the B side. And they said, well, we can't do that, it's too long. And he said, yes, you can. You put it at 33 and a third revs, like an LP in those days.
Yep.
Which finally they agreed to. So you had the A side at 45 and the B side at 33, which was a first, I think.
Yeah, I think it was. And I think it had issues for jukeboxes at the time as well, didn't it?
Oh, well, that was a problem. Yeah, we were in the south of France, and Leo and Chick and I went out for a drink to Albert's bar. Albert was the local taxi driver, and they had a little bar just down the road from where we were recording, in Cap Ferrat, south of France. David Niven, the film actor, had a house on the opposite promontory. And went in, and somebody got up, and I think the people in the bar had recognized us, and somebody got up and put the single on, but they put the B-side on, so it played at 45, so it was twice as fast as it should be. But the bizarre thing was, they got up and danced to it. And when it had finished, they applauded us. You know, we had to sort of take a bow. You know, it was bizarre. So we finished our drinks and left. We went down the next night, and the same darn thing happened. They repeated the process. It was unbelievable. Talk about deja vu.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, Rick, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. We've just brushed over some of the big stories, but you actually do have a book out, don't you, that came out at the start of the year, Headstocks to Woodstock, which goes into a lot more detail on all these big stories and many more as well. I mean, what can fans who've not read that yet, what can they expect from that book?
Well, a lot of the stories I've outlined are in there, of course, but there are many, many others. You know, stories of touring with different bands, you know, Led Zeppelin and Rod Stewart, The Faces. I met Muhammad Ali at one point, and I also met Miles Davis. So there's some a lot of interesting bits and pieces. Everybody that's read it has. All I wanted to do was have somebody say this is a good read. If you whether you knew me or you don't know me, if for instance you know me, so if you read it and then passed it on to a mate of yours and said you've probably not heard of Rick, but have a read. This is a good read. That's all I try to achieve. And everybody so far, touch wood, that's read it has said that. So I achieved what I tried to do.
Absolutely. And that's a great place to finish. Thank you very much, Rick. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. And as I said, I recommend everyone to go out and get the deluxe edition of A Sting in the Tail and check out Headstocks to Woodstock as well. It's a fantastic read.
That's really good of you, Paul. Thank you. We really appreciate your time.
The wonderful Rick Lee there. Now, 10 years after, we're a real staple of the British blues rock scene, consisting of Rick on the drums, Leo Lyons on bass, Chick Churchill on keys, and the enigmatic Alvin Lee on guitar and vocals. Alvin was named the fastest guitarist in the West, and when 10 years after ended, went on to have a solo career too. 10 years after recorded albums between 1967 and 1974, with 1971's A Space in Time going platinum in the US. Here in the UK, it was the four albums before that, though, that fared better. Stonehenge got to number 6, Shush and Cricklewood Green both reached number 4, and What hitting the number 5 spot. Their most recent material with Marcus Bonfanti, who's got great soul and gravitas to his voice, and Colin Hodgkinson, who's worked with some incredible artists over the years as well, is worth checking out. Start with the deluxe version of A Sting in the Tail that we talked about in the interview. Now, it's at this stage of proceedings in the podcast that I give you my favourite songs from the band. Remember, this is my personal choice, not a critic selection. It's just the songs that I like the most. So if you're not overly familiar with the band, these are definitely a good place to start. Here's my top 5 10 years after songs according to Vintage Rock Pod. At 5 is the opening track on the What album from 1971. It's a rocky, upbeat number with a soaring Alvin Lee solo that is his trademark. At number 5 is I'm Coming On. Number 4 is the track that catapulted them to stardom around the world. It's an iconic performance at the most iconic of festivals. They showcased to everyone just what the band were all about. And number 4 is the Woodstock version of I'm Going Home. My number 3 is the group's biggest hit in the UK, hitting number 10 in 1970 from the Cricklewood Green album. The single version chopped the solo out completely, much to the band's annoyance, so the B-side was the full version to be played at the slower 33.5 RPMs, the first such release of its kind. Number 3, for me, is Love Like a Man. And number 2 is a personal favourite of mine. It's taken from the album Shush. It opens with an ominous bass line before kicking in with the pounding, driving drums. It's upbeat with quick lyrics from Alvin. And number 2, for me, is Stoned Woman. And at number 1 is their big hit in the States, featuring an acoustic guitar with nice tempo changes. It feels less blues rock than previous efforts, but it still hits hard. The lyrics still as poignant today as they were then. From the album A Space in Time, the number 1 10 years after song according to Vintage Rock Pod has to be I'd Love to Change the World. And honourable mentions to Working on the Road, Hear Me Calling, and The Dark, Sad Scene 2. But there you go, that's my favourite 5 10 years after songs. As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this list. Where do you agree? Where do you disagree? Drop me an email, vintagerockpod@gmail.com, or message me on the socials. Just search for Vintage Rock Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube, and give us a like or a follow on there as well. A quick shout out to everyone who got in touch about last week's top 5 for Creedence Clearwater Revival. Martin Healy said, I don't disagree with your song choices, but I'd probably change the order. Fair dues. Whereas a lot of shouts for Lodi and Born on the Bayou from people like Nick Holdsworth, Brad Wiseman, and Davey Wheel. Paul Tulk simply messaged to say he just loves all their songs, which is fair play. And a shout out for some lesser vaunted songs as well from Rocky Mullins on Facebook, who said Graveyard Train and Sinister Purpose are his 2 favourite songs. Thanks as always to everyone for interacting. As I said, I love to hear from you, so please check out Vintage Rock Pod on all the social platforms, or you can visit me at vintagerockpod.com. And while you're there, you can join the ever-growing list of VRP VIPs as well, who sign up to become a Vintage Rock Pod VIP. They basically get a once weekly newsletter to make sure you don't miss out on any of the latest news and scoops from the world of Vintage Rock Pod. You get to find out who the guests are that's coming on first. You can get the chance to put your questions to these guests as well, and the chance to win some goodies too. And speaking about winning goodies, don't forget you can win a pair of tickets plus camping to the Stone Dead Festival 2021. Just get to the website vintagerockpod.com, click on the link at the top where it says Win Stone Dead Tickets, it's an answer the dead simple question. It really is too easy, and you'll be in the draw to win those fantastic tickets. And don't forget Vintage Rock Pod Side 2. It's going to be out every Friday, a magazine style show with various different guests on there. It's full of classic rock content. You've got quizzes, you've got news, all that sort of stuff. It's a companion piece to this regular interview show, so don't miss that too. Until the next episode, then, remember, if you come across anyone who isn't a fan of rock, just tell them, my music is better than yours. Take care.